This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. Russia's warplanes bombed Lviv and its missiles struck Kyiv and Kharkiv on Saturday as Moscow followed through on a threat to launch more long-range attacks on Ukraine's cities after its Black Sea Fleet's flagship was sunk this week in besieged Mariupol, scene of the war's heaviest fighting and worst humanitarian catastrophe. Russian troops pressed recent advances, hoping to make up for their failure to capture the capital. Ukraine's deputy prime minister said nine humanitarian corridors had been agreed for Saturday to evacuate civilians, including from the besieged city of Mariupol, by private cars. The minister said in a statement that five of the nine evacuation corridors were from Ukraine's Luhansk region in the east of the country, which local officials have said is under heavy shelling. More than 900 bodies of civilians have been discovered in the Kyiv region following the withdrawal of Russian forces. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
Kyiv police say most of the civilians were shot dead amid signals they were likely simply executed. The jarring toll comes as Moscow is threatening renewed missile attacks on the capital in response to alleged Ukrainian aggression on Russian territory. That warning follows the stunning loss of Moscow's flagship in the Black Sea, which a senior U.S. official confirms was hit by at least one Ukrainian missile. Russia's continuing preparations for a renewed offensive in eastern Ukraine, and fighting also continues in the pummeled southern city port of Mariupol and elsewhere. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. U.S. border authorities arrested 210,000 migrants attempting to cross the border with Mexico in March. It was the highest monthly total in two decades and underscoring challenges in the coming months for U.S. President Joe Biden. The March total is a 24% increase from the same month a year earlier when 169,000 migrants were picked up at the border. It was the start of a rise in migration that left thousands of unaccompanied children stuck in crowded Border Patrol stations for days while they awaited placement in overwhelmed government-run shelters. Biden, a Democrat who took office in January of 2021, pledged to reverse many of the hardline immigration policies of his Republican predecessor, former President Donald Trump. But he has struggled both operationally and politically with high numbers of attempted crossings. Republicans who hope to gain control of the U.S. Congress in November 8th midterm elections say the president's rollback of Trump-era policies has encouraged more illegal immigration. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has attended a massive civilian parade in the capital, Pyongyang, to celebrate a milestone birth anniversary of his state-founding grandfather. State TV showed thousands marching in a choreographed display of loyalty to the Kim family. There were no reports of Kim making a speech during Friday's event, which also did not showcase military hardware. Commercial satellite images in recent weeks have indicated preparations for a large military parade that could take place on the April 25th anniversary of North Korea's army and display the most advanced weapons in Kim's nuclear arsenal, such as intercontinental ballistic missiles. There's also an expectation that Pyongyang will escalate its weapons tests in the coming weeks or months, while diplomacy is stalled. Somalia's newly elected parliament convened for the first time Saturday, bringing the war-ravaged nation a step closer to completing the drawn-out process of appointing a new president. Elections in Somalia follow a complex indirect model whereby state legislatures and clan delegates pick lawmakers for the national parliament, who in turn choose the president. Nearly 300 lawmakers were sworn in on Thursday, already more than a year behind schedule after a chaotic voting process that has been undermined by violence. Recapping this hour's top story, Russian warplanes bombed Lviv and its missiles struck Kyiv and Kharkiv on Saturday as Moscow followed through on a threat to launch more long-range attacks on Ukrainian cities. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining. I'm Pete in D.C.
She will have an opportunity of meeting the Tanzanian in diaspora, to whom she will express her intention, her vision, her goals of becoming the president in 2025. And so he will be collecting support from different Tanzanians who are living abroad, who are in diaspora.
Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu Hassan meets U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris.
Those that we believe that they are still alive, at the last time that they were disengaged, they were separated from those that were rescued, and work towards rescuing the ones that we still believe they are alive. We still believe and hopeful that there are still those that are alive and are willing to come back if they get the chance. That's our belief.
April 14 marks the 8th year abduction of Nigerian schoolgirls from Chibok by armed militants.
The transition is bound to be smooth. It's not going to be successful. We've come a long way. There have been challenges, but we're able to surmount most of these, and we'll be able to have a new constitution.
And Sierra Leone's former president, Enes Bai Koroma, steps down from politics. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's first female president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, met the first female vice president of the United States, Kamala Harris, at the White House Friday. Suluhu's two-week trip focuses on building economic and diplomatic ties. In a meeting with Harris, she discussed global health issues as well as building commercial relations with the United States. Media reports say Tanzania is looking for investment to expand natural gas production, health, agriculture, and infrastructure. Harris underscored the Biden administration's commitment to strengthening ties with Tanzania and other African countries based on mutual respect and equality. She also welcomed Tanzania's support for democracy and human rights. For analysis, reaction, and a look at expectations surrounding Suluhu's trip, I reach a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam, Faraja Lugume.
First of all, the meeting was not publicized in our country. It just came as an emergency message circulating in the social media that the president has gone to America for a state visit, and she's meeting her colleague Kamala Harris. And so people have been speculating what is going on, what is she going to discuss with Kamala Harris, and what will be the outcomes of the visit. So people are still asking themselves several questions. Why now? Because in Tanzania, the situation is very tense, especially when it comes to price hiking of important commodities like fuel, construction materials, etc. So the life in our country is very tough and it's very serious. People are trying to reason, is she going there to share the ideas on how to rescue the economy, or is there anything else? Is she's going to talk to Kamala Harris, or it is an issue of gender and presidency? So people are still asking what is really the purpose of the visit, because it has not been clarified in the public what is the goal of the visit up to now.
Faraja, what do you think are the expectations after the news came out?
So some people are saying maybe she has gone to America to publicize about touristic attractions in Tanzania and to attract investors, because President Samia is fond of investors. He thinks foreign direct investments are more important to our economy. So he's focusing more on attracting foreign direct investment to our country. So these are the two major issues that we expect maybe Tanzanians will benefit from the visit. One is the touristic attraction, promotion of the touristic attractions, and secondly, it's about attracting foreign direct investment.
Do you think her visit would further strengthen the diplomatic bonds or ties between Dodoma and Washington?
Yes, it might be, because during the tenure of President Magufuli, the relationship between Washington and Dodoma was very cold. It was an icy relationship. Maybe this time is the right time for the President Samia Suluhu Hassan to build the lost relationship or the shaken relationship that existed between Dodoma and Washington. So that might also be very important diplomatically when we want to strengthen the ties, because during the Magufuli era, the relationship between Washington and Dodoma was icy, was cold, and some of the issues happened between Washington and Dodoma, and there was an exchange of messages, exchange of words between our Minister of Foreign Affairs and the embassy and the foreign and the American diplomats. But now I think President Samia thinks it's the right time to rebuild or to revive the relationship that had shaken before.
There are also suggestions that her trip here could help her in the next general election. What is your take?
That's very true, because of the three reasons. One, she wants to build her image internationally and to create that image that was lost, that he's embracing international relations or foreign relations with big nations. So that might add a credit to her back home. But secondly, he wants to learn how to build the diplomatic relations with different nations. And if that will happen, it means she will be learning new skills of doing politics from different countries. And that one will also strengthen her way towards presidential election in 2025. But thirdly, you shouldn't ignore the role of the Tanzanians who are in diaspora. The Tanzanians who are in diaspora can mobilize their support to Samia Suluhu Hassan for the 2025 general election. And if that happens, it means by the time he visits the Tanzanian embassies abroad, she will have an opportunity of meeting the Tanzanian in diaspora, to whom she will express her intention, her vision, her goals of becoming the president in 2025. And so he will be collecting support from different Tanzanians who are living abroad, who are in diaspora. If all these three will happen, it means he is strengthening her grip towards the presidency in 2025.
Faraja Lugume is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Nigeria, Thursday, April 14, was the anniversary of the day 8 years ago when schoolgirls from Chibok were abducted by armed militants. Parents, victims, and civil society group leaders and elders of the Chibok community in the southern part of Borno State marked the day by calling on the Nigerian government to step up efforts to rescue the girls who still are being held. Parents and leaders of the Kibaku Area Development Association in the Chibok community say it's a day of disappointment and regret. 8 years ago, Islamic militants from Boko Haram abducted 276 students from the government girls' secondary school in Chibok who were preparing for their final year examination. The abduction drew sharp condemnation from the international community, which demanded the immediate release of the schoolgirls. For the latest development, I reached Dr. Manasseh Allen, Director of Media and Publicity for the Kibaku Area Development Association in Chibok.
The parents plan to issue a passionate appeal once again on the 8th year of the missing of the Chibok girls to plead with the government and all the members of the international community to expedite action on getting the girls that are still alive back, because 8 years after abduction, nobody could describe the pain of a mother or a father that is expecting to see their children that were sent to school, spent 5 years studying, only to reach a point of concluding their final high school exam, and they were whisked away by a group of terrorists. And since then, 8 years today, nobody is saying anything about them.
Dr. Allen, the government has often said that it is doing everything in its power to
ensure that the rest of the still abducted schoolgirls are released. Civil society groups have said that the administration is not doing enough. In the Chibok community, what are you hearing?
From day one, when the girls were abducted, we expected prompt approach to rescue them. We didn't see that. It took days of argument, weeks of blame games, and then it started translating into months. And even when the government was to do something, they were saying the girls have been married off. But 2 years after, a girl escaped on her own. And she said, no, I want to be free. Even when I'm carrying a child of the terrorists, I want to be free because I did not sign up to be abducted. I did not sign up to become a mother at this age. And she escaped. It was when the groups like BBOD keep putting and mounting serious pressure on the government that they began to engage some of the people involved. And we got the release of 21. We later got the release of 82. Batch of the Chibok girls. But we still had over 100 of them missing.
When was the last time leaders of your community met with officials of the government to try to find a solution to some of these concerns you've raised?
We do that periodically and very often. We engage the office of the vice president, we engage the presidency, we engage the Ministry of Women Affairs that they have domiciled the affairs of the Chibok girls to be taken care of. And they have a desk there that is ineffective, that is non-functional. The girls that are in school are even complaining again and again and again to the head of somebody that was placed to be to receive all complaints for on behalf of the government. No response. Nobody responds to anybody.
After the commemoration, what is the next line of action? What are the next steps for you in the effort to try to secure their release?
In the last commemoration, the 7th commemoration, we targeted closure and disclosure. Can the government disclose to Nigerians what happened after the rescue of the Chibok girls? What were the reports of the briefing of the rescued girls? How many of them are still alive? How many have been killed in several of the operations of the Nigerian Air Force, Nigerian Army, the terrorists? And how many died as a result of snake bites, as it was reported in the first few years of abduction? How many died as a result of childbirth? Can the government now talk to these girls that have been rescued, document the list and the detail of those that have died, open up to their parents, let them have closure, let us know exactly how many girls we are expecting to be rescued, those that we believe that they are still alive. At the last time that they were disengaged, they were separated from those that were rescued, and work towards rescuing the ones that we still believe they are alive. We still believe and hopeful that there are still those that are alive and are willing to come back if they get the chance. That's our belief.
Dr. Manasseh Allen is Director of Media and Publicity for the Kibaku Area Development Association in Chibok. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Nigerian Vice President Yemi Osinbajo announced this week that he will seek the nomination of the ruling All Progressive Party, or APC, to run for president next February. He will be running to succeed his boss, Muhammadu Buhari, who is leaving office after serving 2 4-year terms. Political parties in Nigeria are expected to pick presidential candidate by June 3, and official campaigning begins in September. To become the presidential candidate for the ruling party, Osinbajo would have to defeat fellow aspirants, including APC leader and former Lagos State Governor Bola Tinubu, Transport Minister Rotimi Amaechi, and the Governor of Central Kogi State, Yahya Bello. For more about the decision to run for president in next year's general election, I reach Laolu Akande, the vice president's spokesperson.
He has worked with the president at the critical issues and the problems of the country, worked through quite a very difficult period and difficult challenges. So he does have the kind of experience that clearly recommends that a candidate of his kind should be in the race. Secondly, and more importantly, I believe, the vice president considers that every experience that he has had, every insight that he has had, and every opportunity that God has given unto him in life is for the purpose of working with Nigerians to take this country to the level and to bring the Nigeria of our common dreams. So he is motivated as a person based on my experience with him, working with him in these last 8 years.
So Laulu, what makes Vice President Oshibanjo uniquely qualified to become Nigeria's next president?
He has the experience, having served as the vice president, the position that he currently holds. And secondly, he has the competence. As a matter of fact, he has acted a couple times as the acting president, you know, when the president was away and delegated the authority to him, and to the applause of both the president and the people. So I think here's a man that is clearly well prepared in terms of his attitude and composure, in terms of his knowledge and understanding of the issues, and in terms of his ability to relate with the people in a way that resonates with the expectations and the hopes of the Nigerian people.
But what do you say to critics that he is part of the administration that has not improved the living standards of Nigerians, and that the economic challenges Nigeria faces at the moment have not been resolved by this current administration that he's playing a key role in as the vice president? How do you respond to those critics?
The work of the administration is ongoing, and there have been challenges, but there are also tremendous amount of accomplishments, some of them already delivered, and a lot also that are in progress. We have had, for instance, under this administration, we've run what is perhaps one of the biggest social welfare program in sub-Saharan Africa. There has been a tremendous transformation in terms of infrastructure, roads, rail power, and we have an ambitious broadband connectivity infrastructural agenda that is in progress. So yes, it's a question of whether the cup is half empty or half full. This is an administration that is clearly focused, and being somebody that has been working in the administration, working with Mr. President, he clearly stands way above you know, many other people in terms of understanding what the problems are and being in a better position to sort them out.
But the vice president faces a stiff challenge. Within the APC itself, you have a lot of prominent people who are contesting, including the former Lagos State Governor and a chieftain of the APC. You're talking about Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, who worked with the vice president when they were in Lagos State. What do you think are the chances of the vice president to come up tops to represent the APC in the next general election 2023?
Well, I'm not a political pundit, but I can tell you that based on what we have seen, based on the appreciation of his contribution in government, his relationship with people, the common bonds that he shares with the ordinary Nigerian, and based on what several many Nigerians, both of high and low the callings in life, what they've said about him, what they know him to be, I think he stands out very clearly as somebody that can carry the imagination, that can carry the hopes and the expectations of the Nigerian people to that point that is widely desired. I have no doubt in my mind that he is going to be a very, very formidable candidate.
Laulu Akande is the spokesperson for Nigeria's Vice President Yemi Oshibanjo. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In Sierra Leone,
Former President Ernest Bai Koroma says he is stepping down from politics. This after resigning as leader and chairman of the main opposition party, the All People's Congress, or APC. The resignation is generating mixed reactions. Some say it will pave the way for new leadership that will allow the party to prepare for next year's general election. However, others question the timing of the resignation, saying it will weaken the party's ability to defeat incumbent President Julius Maada Bio. For the latest development, I reach Sherif Ismail, a spokesperson for the former Sierra Leonean president.
Well, Peter, you had right. Yes, he is stepping away, and it's not a new decision. He has always made the point that, that he will be taking the back seat, and he has consistently reminded his supporters that this was coming. So, yes, he made a statement yesterday, and it's been widely received in the country.
But, Sherif, some people are expressing concern that he's stepping away from politics, especially a year to next year's general election, could significantly undermine the prospect of the main opposition APC. What is your take on that?
That's an interesting question. But I would say, you know, when you walk on sand, the wind will efface your footsteps. When you walk on rocks, time will efface your footsteps. But when you walk on the minds of people, that would blossom for posterity. You see, President Koma has shown that when the right leaders are elected into office, democracy can really work for the ordinary man. During his tenure, he consolidated peace, he deepened democracy, and he fostered unity and national cohesion. He rebuilt the country. I mean, those actions are imprinted on the minds of Sierra Leonean. And I believe they would always remember the work he has done. So quite the contrary, his departure will not impair the chances of the party in next year's elections. As far as I know, and from what I'm hearing, the people still cherish his legacy, and they have seen the difference since he has left office. And of course, they're now determined to make sure that legacy is not shredded and that it is protected. And I believe they will do so, protecting that legacy by mobilizing to vote in the APC in the next election.
Sherif, some APC supporters that I spoke with are concerned about the timing of his decision to step away from politics because they said they anticipated that he will campaign for the party in next year's general election. Stepping away as a statesman, they said, could really inhibit, and it might make it tough for the party. How do you address this concern from people in the APC who worry that his stepping away could have a negative effect on the fortunes of the party?
Well, the fact is politics is always a tough business. But the fact also remains that there's always a time to lead and a time to leave. And knowing when to leave is a distinguishing feature of a great leadership. What's also more important is that when you leave at the time when you're still popular, it shows statesmanship. And I believe that is what exactly President Koma has demonstrated. His departure is not a sudden news. And I do not see how this would affect the membership confidence and morale. Yes, there are some mixed feelings. Yes, there are so many people who want him to stay on. Yes, he's still very influential. And it doesn't necessarily mean that he will not be there to support the party, to help the party through the next election. He's still in the country and he's still influential, and he will do what he will have to do to support the party and enhance its chances in next year's election.
Some APC members are wondering if there is going to be a smooth transition and whether the former president would lead this process.
Absolutely. The transition is very important, and this is exactly why he has been around all this long, because he wanted to accompany the party, to accompany the process, to ensure that everything is in place and organized and orderly for the next leadership. So yes, the transition is bound to be smooth. It's not going to be successful. We've come a long way. There have been challenges, but we're able to surmount most of these, and be able to have a new constitution. And we are concluding some of the residual challenges we have in court and some other internal party issues. All of these have been concluded, and we are heading to convention as a very strong and unified and determined party to come to power.
Sharif Ismail is a spokesperson for former Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. The United Nations has released $100 million from its Central Emergency Response Fund to help millions facing hunger in South Sudan, Somalia, Sudan, Nigeria, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Yemen. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Millions in these seven countries cannot feed themselves and their families because of armed conflict, drought, and economic turmoil made worse by COVID-19. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs also says the spillover effects of the war in Ukraine threaten to drive millions of people even closer to famine. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA Yemen, South Sudan, and Somalia are already in what the United Nations calls a Phase 5 emergency, catastrophic hunger or famine.
Other countries such as Nigeria, Sudan, and Kenya, for example, Ethiopia as well, we have millions of people who are just one step away from this catastrophic phase. And if we have to avoid that they end up in that phase, because that's where people literally die from starvation and disease on our watch. If we have to avoid that, we need to act now.
Ukraine and Russia are known as the breadbasket of the world, supplying nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley exports. The World Food Program says the war in Ukraine will increase global hunger. It says the conflict is disrupting food and energy markets and driving food prices beyond consumers' reach. The United Nations launched appeals for each of the seven countries months ago for a global total of $43 billion. Laerke says only 6.5% of this amount has been funded. He says the UN knows the $100 million it has made available for emergency relief will not solve the problems facing these countries.
But it does plug a hole. It does cover a gap that is immediate, that is urgent, and that is absolutely necessary if we want to save lives in these countries. And that is the function of the Central Emergency Response Fund. It's kind of a provider of last resort.
Laerke says UN agencies hope donors will understand the situation facing these countries and support their humanitarian operations. If not, he says, drastic cuts will have to be made in critical projects. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Yeah. No, 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 no. Only got time for the big things, yeah, yeah, yeah.
mamacita, te amo. Love the way that you are always for me. Señorita, te amo. Love the way that I put it all there for me. Puede que seas mi amiga. Girl, you know that I love you. Oh, oh, oh. Ikawungu, kikawungu. Anything that you want me to, girl, I could do for you. Yes, mi amiga. Girl, I just won't be a friend. Ya bomi na kupenda.
Oh,
That was Music from the Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a living dog is better than a dead lion. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.